Welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. My name is Eddie LeSure, and I'll be joined very soon by my co-host Margaret Kirshner and our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at wpvmfm.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And once again, I want to welcome our listeners into A Mindful Emergence, and at this point, say hello to my co-host, Margaret Kirshner.
Hello, everyone.
Yeah, and also at this point, I'd like to welcome into the WPVM studios our guest for this week, Monica LeBlanc, and the topic is love, family, and addiction. And Monica is a licensed professional counselor, licensed clinical addiction specialist. Welcome to the studio, Monica.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So love, family, and addiction. You work with individuals and families around the issue of addiction, correct?
I do, yeah, individuals and couples.
Yeah, give us an idea what we're going to be focusing on for the next hour or so, if you would.
Yeah, so as of late, addiction's been getting quite the spotlight in our news and in our community, particularly around opioids. And so I kind of came up through inpatient and outpatient treatment. That's where I got a lot of my training. And I so now I primarily work with folks who, not folks who are addicted, but folks who love someone who has an addiction. So siblings, parents, friends, partners. A lot of times that kind of role can come with a lot of anxiety and exhaustion and trauma. And so that's kind of primarily the work that I do now.
Yeah, because addiction doesn't just impact the person who is dealing with either the substance use disorder or the behavior. Impacts everybody around them, doesn't it? Especially the family?
Absolutely, yeah. So addiction is what's known as a systems disease, meaning that it doesn't just impact the person who's using, but it impacts, it creates kind of a ripple effect where it impacts everybody kind of in the system. So families, communities, schools, organizations, right? This is a ripple thing, so.
It's probably hard to find someone who doesn't know someone in addiction or in recovery or hasn't been affected by addiction one way or the other. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I would say that's fair. I'm trying to think in my head right now if I know anyone that I could safely say has never really been impacted, and I can't think of any.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was at an addiction conference last year, and there was a gentleman doing one of the presentations who basically came right out and said, you know, he runs a treatment center. I think it's down in Charlotte. He said, if we're not treating the whole family, then we're not really addressing the issue.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The people tend to have the most success when their family also engages in a treatment process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you have a practice here in Asheville. You have an office downtown?
I do. My office is in the W.G. Smith building, the big green Queen Anne, full of ghosts and lovely vibes. And my practice is called Cardinal River Counseling, and I'm very lucky to be practicing here in Asheville.
Yeah. And but you didn't grow up around here.
I didn't. I kind of grew up all over the place. I moved a lot as a kid. I moved here from Charlotte and was super happy to be here when I got here 11 years ago.
Okay.
It feels like home to me. These mountains and this community is where I did a lot of my own healing. And so it feels really special to me to be able to help folks engage in their own healing here.
So you did a lot of your own healing. What else would you like to say about that?
I did. I think that I came to Asheville. It's a funny story of how I got here, but I had no idea what Asheville was. I didn't know what it was like, but people just kept telling me
it's
to go there.
It's the cesspool of sin. Didn't
right?
You know
exactly.
That?
Well, it wasn't that 11 years ago, but people just kept telling me to go there. People kept being like, go to Asheville. You'll fit in great there. Right.
They knew you.
Exactly. Yeah. And I got here and I was like, oh, okay. Uh-huh. I'm home.
But
yeah.
Even 11 years ago, it was a little different from what it is today.
For sure. Yeah. I kind of liked the small town, big city all in one and the safety of the mountains. And I think I came here where my heart was just looking for a place to call home and got everything that I needed to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to UNC Asheville for undergrad, and I did a bachelor's in clinical psych and a bachelor's in women, gender, and sexuality study. Wild feminist over here, for sure.
Right on.
And I went to graduate school at Western Carolina.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. So you're able to stay in this general area.
Yeah.
So you're a licensed professional counselor, which means what?
That means that I practice mental health therapy. That means that I went through a lot of years of training and I'm in a lot of debt.
All right.
Yeah.
Because you're also a licensed clinical addiction specialist. Mm-hmm. So you have to go through a process there and take tests.
Yes. Yeah.
With the state as well as with the school.
Well, there's a national board for the for both of those, actually, but and then there's a state board.
Yeah.
Yeah, for both of them also, yeah.
Well, we know people that have just gone through that process, don't we, Margaret?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, and in the program we're in, the CSAC program, it's similar, but I don't think the test is as stringent.
Mm-hmm.
But we passed.
Congratulations. Oh, my gosh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a hard test.
Yeah, yeah, we were pretty stressed about it.
Yeah.
And pretty relieved when we finished the testing. Mm-hmm. So what was it about your upbringing, your background that where you decided, I want to be a counselor and I want to help people?
Yeah. So it's very, you know how you have those moments in your life where just something hits you and becomes really clear and you don't know where it came from or why. I had a moment like that. I was sitting in Dr. William Bruce's abnormal psych class in college. Hi, Dr. Bruce, if you're listening. I was just sitting there and we were talking about neuroses. And I was sitting there and I was like, I have that. Oh, God. I was like, I so have that. I am super neurotic. And then I was like, wait, but I should help people that have that. Mm-hmm. And I was like 20 years old. I was like, I'll be really good at helping people with their neuroses. And then
who better?
Right? Exactly.
Yes.
And then I was like, oh, I'm neurotic. I should be a therapist. Right. I was like, oh, I want to be a substance abuse therapist. And like, so then I just, went on and I got an internship at October Road. Was my first
mm-hmm. yeah.
experience in the field, and man, my supervisor, she told me about myself, and I love and appreciate her for that. So I was there. I was at a Next Step Recovery mm-hmm. for a while, and then I did most of my years at Swain Recovery Center.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and say what Swain Recovery Center is.
So Swain Recovery Center is a 42-day private nonprofit inpatient facility. It's dual diagnosis, so it's for folks who have substance abuse primary diagnosis, but also mental health issues. It's located in Black Mountain, and they treat adults, adolescents, men, and women all on the same unit. So it's a very, very, very unique program. Their primary modalities are like acceptance and commitment training, and they do a lot of experiential stuff. And the staff there and everyone there is just so wonderful. I was just there Friday for lunch, and I just, that place just feels like home to me.
Well, I've been out there, and I've fortunately not as a patient. I was able to avoid that, but it's a wonderful program out there. And of course, there are people there that are very near and dear to mm-hmm. both our hearts, mm-hmm. and Margaret's as well. Vern is out there. So, you mentioned earlier, we're really, I don't know if you used the word epidemic, but I will if you didn't, mm-hmm. in terms of substance use disorder. But it's more than just the opioids, because behavioral addictions, process addictions, which the terms I just used, would you mind defining those?
Sure.
Since you're the therapist and I'm not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So when we're talking about a process addiction, then we're talking about an addiction to kind of a ritual, right? So things like gambling, shopping, things that kind of also hijack the reward system, but aren't necessarily defined by a substance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, gambling is a really good example, because there's those intermittent rewards that get provided when someone's gambling, which feels a lot, and our brain thinks is a lot like getting high. So people can become addicted to behaviors, to processes, right, just as much as they can substances, which kind of leads us into the evidence that addiction is actually a brain disease, right?
Yeah.
It's something chemically in the brain that's messing up.
Yeah, and it's not about the drug, for example. You know, I was listening to a video the other day by Dr. Gabor Mate, whom we all absolutely adore, and he was saying, well, the good evidence of that is to talk about gambling. He mm-hmm. said no one would suggest a deck of cards creates an addiction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's not the deck of cards.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's such a powerful example because, yeah, it's not the deck of cards. It's not the pornography. It's not the heroin necessarily.
It's not the job.
Right? Not the job.
How many people have work addictions?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Not the shopping mall. So kind of another framework that addiction can be looked at, and this one kind of makes the most sense to me, is through attachment.
Yeah.
So as we're born, we form attachment to our primary caregivers. And I'm going to talk about Charles Darwin just for a quick second. So Charles Darwin, in The Origin of Species, I think he might mention natural selection like once, but what he mentions like over 1,000 times is bond and affiliation, and how we need bond and affiliation to survive. Like, that is one of the most primal. We need it like air. Like, we mm-hmm. have to form connection and we have to create community. So what that has to do with addiction is that if addiction is an attachment disorder, that means that when someone is addicted to something, their primary attachment, instead of being to other humans, is to a substance or is to that gambling high. It's not what they're evolutionarily supposed to be attached to. We're supposed to be connected and attached to one another, right? And that's actually the healing for addiction, comes in connection. That's why 12-step groups work so well. It's the community
exactly.
that heals, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
the connection. Yeah.
And it's a spiritual malady mm-hmm. because connecting to other people is a spiritual experience.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think not only are we connecting to other people, we're connecting to ourselves, our own mm-hmm. bodies, and our breath, and higher power. And of course, other people are a part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you familiar with Rat Park?
Yes.
The
yeah.
Rat Park experiment?
Yes. Why don't you tell people who are not familiar
okay.
with that?
Okay.
Yeah.
That
before
means.
You before you do that, and I want to hear that, I just want to remind our listeners, if you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on the new WPVM LP in Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7 on your dial, and streaming globally at WPBMFM.org. Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by Monica LeBlanc, a licensed professional counselor and licensed clinical addiction specialist, talking about love, family, and addiction.
Great. Yeah. So So Rat Park is so cool. It's one of my favorite like things I ever learned about in school. So basically what they did was they put a rat in a cage with water, food, and cocaine. The little sippy bottle full of cocaine. So the rat, of course, became addicted to the cocaine and didn't really even want water or food. It just wanted more cocaine. So then they were like, okay, well, we noticed that this rat is alone. I wonder what would happen if we put another rat in there. So they take another rat. They put it in the same cage, water, food, cocaine, and now the rat has sex. And so the rat apparently began to use the cocaine maybe about 75% as much as it was before. So 25% less, right? It has one other rat in the cage. So then they take these rats and they put them in an amazing rat amusement park with all these diddly dods and hamster wheels and a million other rats. And they have rat recreation. There's probably a rat spa in there, right?
And rat foot massage.
Yeah, exactly. They had rat yoga, whatever.
I got to see that.
Yeah.
Rat music.
That's right. Rat music. Oh, yeah. So those rats, they had the same setup, right? They had water, food, and cocaine. Mm-hmm. Barely ever touched the cocaine because they had all the things that they need to fill their spirit, right? To be spiritually well, they had everything that they needed. So there wasn't a necessity to attach to the substance.
Yeah, yeah. So as you do, working with couples, mm-hmm. and do you actually work with family units so much, or is it mostly just couples?
So I work with individuals who have a worry, right, about their loved one. And then I work with couples, and a lot of the couples that I work with, one person in the couple usually has a substance issue and the other person does not.
Right. So you've seen evidence of how addiction has torn apart families.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. So, I'm gonna go a little backwards here and talk a little bit about how I got interested in working in families because it's relevant. When I worked at Swain, my favorite group that we did there was called Multifamily Group. And it was where all the families would come and we would sit in a circle with the clients and their families. And these groups got huge. And the families would take turns hashing it out, right? talking about the real stuff in the family that they hadn't had a chance to talk to. So, or talk about. And it was really beautiful to watch the family members get to kind of speak their truth for the first time because their loved one was sober, so they were listening.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was really, really, really beautiful to kind of watch that. Yeah. And addiction can put, there's all these roles, right? So kind of in the popular vernacular, there's, the chemically dependent person, the hero, the jester, the lost
child. Oh, the archetypes
child,
you're
right?
talking about,
yeah.
right? Okay.
Yeah. That kind of get created. They're actually defense mechanisms, right? They get created to deal with the addiction in the family. And so those defense mechanisms keep the family from being able to connect with one another. And that was really, that's kind of what I see pretty often, is that these defense mechanisms serve as a block to the family being able to communicate and connect with one another.
Wow.
So how can a loved one be helpful to the person who is struggling with their addiction?
Yeah, so I get that question a lot. And no one likes my answer.
Well, we'll probably like it.
Right. So my answer to that question is, take care of your damn self. It's a full-time job. As my old boss at Swain would say, it is a full-time job. And because what happens is the better we take care of ourselves, the more we model what a spiritually and psychologically fulfilling life looks like, the more we attract that, right? And so in taking really good care of ourselves, we teach our loved ones what that looks like. And so, yeah, sure, that might mean setting some boundaries with love. That might mean protecting yourself. That might mean that you're not waiting by the phone at 3 a.m. waiting for the call, right? And so, do you want to live a happy life? Do you want to live peacefully? And do you want to be able to do that whether your loved one is using or not?
Do you find people saying, well, I can't do that because what they're thinking is it's selfish?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that I always thought that if I wrote a book on this topic, if I wrote a book like just for my population, I would call it From Selfish to Selfless, mm-hmm. like a manual for self-care. Because one of the things is that, I get the selfish piece. Like, I get that it feels selfish to take care of yourself and to not be giving to your loved one. And we cannot pour from an empty cup. And if we are pouring from an empty cup, everything that we are pouring is imaginary. So that goes for our relationships and our loved ones too, right? If my cup is full, then I have something to offer. If I'm taking good care of myself, then I'm a better daughter, wife, mother, partner, sister, friend. And if I'm not taking care of myself, then I'm grumpy.
Yeah. So if we've got a loved one who is struggling and they're going down, it's kind of like quicksand. If we get in the quicksand with them, we're both going down, or the whole family's going down together. But if some of us are able to take good care of ourselves and stay on solid ground and be able to model what that looks like and reach out and help, you know, there's a chance that our loved one can actually, you know, come out of that quicksand and onto some stable, solid ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you show them what solid ground looks like.
Yeah.
And that is the most loving thing that you can do for someone.
I totally agree.
How do you respond to the term tough love? What does that word mean to you, and how do you relate to it?
I think that the phrase tough love has good intentions, and I think that its intention is about setting boundaries, and I understand, you know, kind of why people use the word tough love, because it feels tough. And kind of the way that I like to talk about, you know, oh, well, how do I know what's a boundary and what's an ultimatum, right? Like, what's the difference? I like to talk about that like a boundary is something that you set out of love for yourself, a way to protect yourself. And an ultimatum is something that you give hoping the other person will change. So I set boundaries for myself out of a love and a relationship with myself. Anything where I'm expecting you to change is probably not going to work. And I'm probably going to end up frustrated and disappointed.
And resentful.
Totally.
It's a setup, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Do you talk to people about specific examples of self-care, you know, things like, hey, take a bath, buy yourself some flowers, go for a walk in the woods. Do you actually have those kind of conversations with people?
Yeah, I like to talk about people, and I like to think of self-care as a journey too. I remember for myself when my graduate school professors first kind of introduced me to the idea of self-care, I was like, okay, whatever that is. And I was like, oh, this is self-care. Like, I can watch the eighth episode of Grey's Anatomy in a row. Yeah. Like, that's going to be so awesome.
Eat a whole liter of Rocky Road.
I can totally finish off these Oreos. I'm taking care of myself. Woohoo, winning. and then I started to kind of figure out, like,
maybe not.
Well, how do I feel after that eighth episode of Grey's Anatomy? And how do I feel after the second bag of Oreos? And paying attention to what is life giving versus what is life sucking, right? So, yes, sometimes it feels really, really good to watch a couple episodes of Grey's Anatomy, right? Sometimes it feels really, really good to have that fourth Oreo. And other times what I need and what's life-giving to me are things that are like yoga and taking a deep breath and going for a nice walk and buying some fresh flowers and smiling at the guy on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in a way, both the person who's in active addiction and the person who's living with them, who's in partnership with them, are just finding ways just to cover up the troubles, bury the troubles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Avoiding them.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to think about the term rescuing. So when I worked at Swain, we had a group rule. It was called no rescuing. And that meant that if someone was crying, that you couldn't hand them a tissue. Because, not because we're mean, but because that person is fully capable and we believe in their ability to get their own tissue. So rescuing means doing for someone else what they are fully capable of doing for themselves. And that a lot of times in an addiction dynamic looks like, yeah, making excuses like, oh, you know, daddy's tired. He's taking a nap, kids. Like, let's be quiet, right? Like, that's kind of the classic addiction family example. Or, you know, making up an excuse about why someone isn't out of function, right? Protecting them from their natural consequence of their choices, their behavior. And in doing so, potentially sacrificing oneself.
As well as robbing them of the opportunity to deal with their consequences.
Yeah. To experience
them.
Right.
In a way that might open a door for them to want to get help.
Absolutely. Because I think that as people who love, right? And if you love like I do, which I know you guys do, it's just like this fierce, like, I want to protect you from all of the pain in the world. And the pain is where we learn, right? The pain is where we get to those consequences, like experiencing that and being in the quicksand. That's how we grow. That's how we become better. So if I deny you that experience, then I'm denying you your growth.
Yeah.
And so what I can do as a loved one is to just say, yo, I know that it sucks that you got fired because you were too hungover to go to work. That really, really sucks. I'm here for you. Love you. Sorry about that. You know, like, end of story.
Yeah, exactly.
That was very well said.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of, when I asked that last question, I was sort of setting up this piece of music because I use the term bury your troubles. Bury My Troubles is the name of the song that I'm going to play now. We're going to take a musical break. You're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPBM FM in Asheville, North Carolina. Margaret and I are going to return with our guest, Monica LeBlanc, in just a moment. But this is a tune by a singer named Imelda May called Bury My Troubles. Hope you enjoy it.
My baby, no one will ever know what I don't want to show. I locked them away, so I did, yes I did. I'm going to bury my troubles away. I'm going to bury my troubles away. Oh, worry, stop haunting me. Don't you keep down to me. I won't be no slave. I put you to rest for good. I did the best I could to get into your grave. And so I dig, yes I dig. I'm going to bury my troubles away. I'm going to bury my troubles away. Oh, what I'm saying. Ashes and dust to dust, that is the end of us. Oh Lord, I'm praying. So I dig, yes I dig. I'm going to bury my troubles away. I'm going to bury my troubles away. I'm going to bury my troubles away. I'm gonna bury my troubles away. I'm going to bury my troubles away.
There you have Imelda May, Bury My Troubles Away. This is Eddie Lesher, and from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPBM, Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPBMFM.org, Mondays from 7 to 8 p.m. and Thursdays from 9 to 10 a.m., which is the rebroadcast, past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. You can easily locate them by just going to our website, opening up the schedule, and selecting this show, which, of course, is listed Mondays at 7 p.m. We're broadcasting live Monday, November 13th, 2017. This is program number 97. Almost 2 years we've been doing this program, Margaret.
Wow.
Yeah. All our shows are made possible by A Mindful Emergence, LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. We also offer trainings for CEU credits to healthcare professionals. You can access more information online at amindfulemergence.com, as well as on Facebook and LinkedIn, where you can find us. And you can send questions, comments, requests, contact us or our guests by emailing Margaret and I at discover@amindfulemergence.com. And by the way, if you're on Facebook, we invite you to link A Mindful Emergence as well as WPBM 103.7. So one other thing I'll mention before we return to our guests. If you're enjoying this program, we have a lot of other great shows on WPVM, but one in particular I invite you to check out is Thursdays at 5 p.m. when McNair Ezard hosts A Better World, which is a show that looks at people and organizations that are working in areas such as hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, the environment, and spirituality. He interviews people who are out there really making a difference. And our guest is making a difference, Monica LeBlanc, a therapist doing work around love, family, and addiction.
And Monica, you have so eloquently said that therapy is a conversation where you get to be the expert and I get to hold the hope. And I'd like to hear more about your approach as it relates to addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that quote is from my website. Yeah, is that where you got that?
Yeah, it came from your bio.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I really do believe that everybody that comes into my office is the expert on their own life. That's kind of what I mean when I say you get to be the expert. And that kind of came out of my time in treatment, in the working in the treatment setting, because lots of times clients would ask me, you know, are you in recovery? And what they're really asking me is, do you understand me?
Yes.
Can you understand what my life is and what I've gone through?
And can you help me?
Absolutely.
Can I trust you?
Yeah. Can I trust you? Do you get it? Are you going to judge me? And so I think one of the misconceptions of the way that we connect as humans is that we connect on experience. But if I break my arm and Eddie breaks his arm, I can't say with 100% certainty that I know what Eddie's pain feels like, right? Like, I can't say that. I don't know that.
True.
So I can understand how Eddie feels, right? But I may never understand his experience from his perspective, what he went through, right? So that's kind of what I mean when I say that, you know, the the person sitting in front of me gets to be the expert. And I get to be the person who doesn't give up, right? I get to be the person who gets to look at them in all of their expertise and say, I see so much hope and so much beauty and so much wonderfulness coming out of your process. And, you know, I get to be the person that gets to hold on to that, which is really a beautiful gift. So kind of how that relates to my approach is kind of the question that you asked is I feel like I get really nitty gritty and real with my clients pretty quickly. I would describe my approach primarily as experiential. So what that means is that sometimes if we just kind of verbally talk about stuff, it's hard to get to the places that are actually really meaningful. But if we experience it, if we create an experience around a particular element, that can oftentimes produce insight a lot quicker and a lot more effectively. So one kind of silly thing that I do sometimes in my office is I'll arm wrestle my clients. I'm being 100% serious. And I do this to illustrate how, and we'll talk about, you know, like when I, you know, okay, so stop when I say stop, right? And so I'll ask them if they can understand how I was feeling when I said stop. And, you know, sometimes they'll philosophize about, you know, oh, well, you were probably in pain or maybe you didn't feel anything or whatever that was. And so I kind of use that experience to illustrate how we can never actually understand or protect someone else from their own experience because we don't know what their experience is until they tell us. So I'll use that a lot with folks who are struggling with someone who has an addiction, because a lot of times there's a desire to, oh, I don't want to make them sad. I don't want to make them mad. I don't want to upset them. I don't want to cause them to use, right? And so we can never actually be responsible for the cause of someone else's pain or feeling or whatever, right? Because we don't know. Right. If I'm arm wrestling with you, you don't know what's going on for me and vice versa, unless I tell you, unless I verbalize.
So if someone's going through a hard time, how helpful is it just to say, tell me more about what you're going through?
I mean, I think that I'm sure that would depend on the situation and the person. But I know for me, if I'm going through a hard time and someone said, tell me more about what's going on with you, I would probably really appreciate that. I think just a listening ear can be really helpful. Again, as long as it's not at the expense of your time and your sacrifice, right? When I'm checking out at the grocery store, I ain't trying to really be like, hey, lady, tell me about what's going on with you today. Just trying to buy my celery and go home.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So codependency is a word that I hear a lot. People talk a lot about. Define that. And does that something you talk about in the work that you do?
I do. That, you know, that word is popular. It comes up a lot. So kind of some of the history of that word in particular is that it came out of the kind of the original 12-step groups, the Bill W. It was a group that was formed, kind of codependency or the enabler, right? Was kind of this new,
talk about Al-Anon?
Yeah, Al-Anon, the new kind of support area, but it was mainly for wives. So it was a place, you know, it was a term that kind of defined a behavior of a wife in particular with her husband who usually suffered from alcoholism. This was like a long time ago. And then Melody Beatty wrote Codependency No More.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the, you know, the codependency Bible. And she has since...
It's like the big book of
absolutely,
codependency.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. So she has since come out with several newer books and kind of admitted to the heteronormative nature of her original text. But basically what codependency is that kind of that concept of rescuing. It's so if we're talking about it in terms of attachment, the person who's addicted to the substance, their primary attachment is to the substance. And then the codependent or the enabler, right, the person who's in relationship with that person, their primary attachment is to that person's addiction, not that person, but that person's addiction. So that means like worrying about it, trying to control it, or just completely ignoring it and acting like everything is fine. That's kind of the other extreme, right? But developing an attachment with, instead of with a human, because you can't when someone is using substances, they are attached to that person's addiction.
So
that
becomes,
right, that becomes the primary relationship for them.
Is rescuing the same as enabling?
Yeah, I would say that I'm not so sure I would use them interchangeably. You know, enabling in kind of is kind of a shaming term that was used kind of back in the day to blame the, you know, the person in relationship with the person who had an addiction for, you know, well, you bought them the alcohol or you gave them money or you let them live in your house, and has been used in kind of a shaming way. So I don't tend to use that term in my practice too much.
But you find that programs like Al-Anon and Naranon and CODA, ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholic Adults, I think it's, is that what it stands for?
Yeah, Adult Children of Alcoholics, yeah. And I think they added dysfunctional families.
So you find those programs helpful?
I do. I think that just like the healing from addiction requires the acquisition of connection and community, so does the healing from codependency, right? So if someone's experiencing someone else's addiction and it's concerning to them, or they find that they're spending a lot of time thinking about it or worrying about it, they have a healing process to engage in also. And so those support groups, Al-Anon, Naranon, CODA, ACOA, can be really, really helpful in engaging in one's own healing process and creating community around the issue.
Community is key, isn't it?
So key. So important.
Yeah. So what happens to the family system? How does that change in one of these dynamics, okay, when the person finds recovery?
Oof. Yeah.
I mean, that's probably a pretty big question.
Yeah. Well,
what have you noticed?
Yeah, that was and still has been probably one of the most profound things to watch, was how the family changes when the person decides that it's time to get better. So a lot of times sometimes the chemically dependent person or the person with the addiction can be the scapegoat of the family, which means that they are the source of all of the finger pointing and problems, and they're kind of, their job is to be the problem of the family so that the family has someone to point at. And then when that person decides to get better, all of a sudden they become a mirror. And instead of the family being able to point at them and say, you're the problem, the person becomes a mirror, and the family has to then start looking at their own behavior and their own role and how they functioned to keep this sickness alive and well in the system. And that can be really, really tough and for family members. I think that's a big obstacle into family members getting and engaging in the healing that they really need to, because there's some responsibility to be taken there, which can be really hard.
Yes, I see that. Even as the person who's been addicted is ready for recovery, it doesn't necessarily mean that mom and dad and sister and brother and children,
husband and wife
are also ready.
Yeah.
Do you see them sometimes sabotaging their family member's recovery because they know that when their loved one recovers, that requires that they shift and change as well, that suddenly this dynamic has changed? In other words, let's say I'm with somebody who's an addict and they get clean, and all of a sudden my role has changed. Maybe I don't feel important anymore.
Yeah.
Because I'm not taking care of them. They're actually responsible for their own lives, and maybe I sabotage it because it's uncomfortable for me. Is this, does this kind of thing happen?
Yeah. So it's kind of the question of, if you don't need me, will you want me?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And that, you know, I would say that, you know, that happens all the time in families whenever there's a big change, right? Whenever someone kind of goes through a big personal growth, or they change what's called the homeostasis, or the baseline of the family. So every family operates on this kind of baseline level where, and everyone kind of has a job to keep the family at whatever the baseline is. So anytime there's an elevation or a de-escalation of baseline, people freak out, right? And yeah, certainly is the if you don't need me, will you want me concept.
I liked you better when you were drinking.
Yeah.
Because I knew how to act.
Yeah. Or I felt...
Even though you were crashing the car and getting DUIs and emptying the bank account, yeah, at least I knew where I stood.
Or there's a dynamic that gets created where there's like a... I'm less of a mess, right? Like, let's play the who's less of a mess game, right?
Yes, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. Margaret and I are joined this week by Monica LeBlanc, a therapist who works with love, family, and addiction. I know one thing you want to talk about is the Enneagram.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Yeah. So,
how do you use that? What is it?
For sure. So the Enneagram is kind of it's a specialty niche of mine. And, it's basically the world's oldest spiritual growth model that is available to us. So if you think about it, people like to talk about it like it's a personality model, but I don't really like to use the word personality, because it's more about creating kind of a defense mechanism that we create through stress and trauma. And so it's kind of like, you know how you have your zodiac sign, right?
And
your zodiac sign's like, Eddie, you're a Leo, so that means this about you.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the Enneagram is like that, but it's also like, and when you're healthy, you look like this. And when you're stressed, you look like this. And when you may have some layering of subtypes. So the tradition that I'm taught in is... called the embodiment tradition, which is really focused on energetics. And so people use, the way it kind of ties in with my addiction work is that people use substances to change their physiology, right? They say, this doesn't feel good. I want to feel different.
Right. Well, comfort seeking.
Exactly. So the Enneagram has 9 different energetic types or patterns. And the 9 different types or patterns kind of energetically correlate with the different kinds of drugs or substances that people tend to use to change their physiology. So it can be a really helpful tool in helping people just engage in their self-growth process, learn about their type, and learn about kind of how to reach their highest self. It gives a direct pathway and gateway to, this is how you reach your highest self. If you want to be the best Leo you can be, this is how you do it, right? That's basically how it is.
So it's like a questionnaire or something? They have to answer a bunch of questions?
There are questionnaires out there.
How do you use it?
I don't use questionnaires, because the tradition that I'm taught in, because it's based in energetics, kind of how I learned how to use it and how to help people type themselves was about what it feels like to kind of be in their energy. Mm. So it feels different for me to be in the energy of an 8 than it would for me to be in the energy of a 6, right? Because I'm neither of those types, but I know how it feels when I'm with one of them. So it's kind of an interesting way to learn about things. Again, very, very, very experiential. But yeah, we do workshops periodically. So I'm getting on with the school here in Asheville. They're called the Enneagram Center of Asheville. And so we teach periodic workshops. I think the website is just enneagramasheville.com or something. You can go there. And
could you spell Enneagram?
It's E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M.
Enneagram, yeah. Now, this is a good time to give out your website so people can find out more about you and what you do. And you mentioned before we came on the air that you're in the early stages of developing something. Maybe you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am looking to do, I'm collaborating with an acupuncturist, actually, to do a smoking cessation group in January. And so we're just kind of working on getting that off the ground. I will be sure to be posting more information on my website about that, which is www.cardinal, like the bird, cardinalrivercounseling.com.
And you're on Facebook. Is your business on Facebook? So
sure
they can
is.
Like you on Facebook and get information on that. Are you on LinkedIn too? Are you,
I am.
Are you like a social media maniac?
You know, I try really hard to be, but I honestly, I find it exhausting. So I'm like, I like get really excited about it and I like do it a lot and then I forget and then it goes away for a month.
I actually took a class at AB Tech and learn about all these different things. And then I got overwhelmed and I just stick to Facebook and do some stuff on LinkedIn. And
good call.
And we've got a website that keeps me slightly insane.
Yeah.
I was screaming obscenities yesterday.
Oh,
Margaret will tell you because I got so frustrated. So that's enough for me.
Yeah.
That's enough
Absolutely.
For me.
It can get overwhelming.
Well, I know that we learn best by experiencing something rather than reading about it or talking about it. So can you give us maybe another example of how you work with someone experientially, either with the Enneagram or in any other way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So like I said, so experiential is a lot about creating an experience, right? It's about having something happening in the room and kind of processing what's going on in the room, using the relationship or what's happening between us to really gain some insight about what's happening. So one of the things that my family really likes to laugh at me about is this technique that I use. I call it blanket anger. And so I kind of came up with this in the very, very, very early stages of learning how to work with couples. And I was in this couple session. I think it was maybe my third couple session I had ever done as a therapist. I was so nervous. And this couple was just, they were loud. They were screaming at each other. I hadn't learned how to really create structure or safety in the room yet. So I was just sitting there like, oh gosh, what do I do? And I had a blanket in my office and I was like, I really just want to put the blanket over my head because I just don't know what to do. And they're just screaming at each other and I feel overwhelmed and I don't really know what to do. So I did. I put the blanket over my head.
Okay.
And then they continued to scream at each other until they noticed that the blanket was on my head.
Mm-hmm.
And then they looked at me and they were like, what are you doing? What is she doing? And so then they stop screaming and they start to like communicate with me. And I kept the blanket
You're
on my head.
Still under the blanket at
still
this
under
point.
The blanket, yeah. I kept the blanket on my head, but they started to communicate with me and then communicate with each other in this way that was really de-escalated. So eventually I took the blanket off my head and I asked them to process what it was like to speak to me with a blanket on my head.
Huh.
So they identified that it was at first hilarious and then very strange and then eventually just really awkward. And so I asked them to tell me why they felt like it was awkward. And one of the things that they said was, well, we couldn't see you. We couldn't connect with you. And so
what a metaphor.
Exactly. So I used that to demonstrate how, like, when anger gets so escalated, we can't connect, we can't hear each other. I can't be with you in the room when you're screaming at me, right? And that was literally my experience of being in that room was, I can't be here, I have to go somewhere else.
Right.
So how could they productively communicate with each other if the energy was that high and that intense?
And it's a metaphor for self-protection, too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Exactly.
Creating boundaries.
It was kind of scary for you, probably, with all that anger flying around the room.
Oh, yeah. I was like, 25, and I'm like, oh, my God.
And you couldn't leave because you were in the role of therapist.
Yes.
Right. So it's not like you could leave the room.
Yes. Yeah. So my family likes to you know, nudge me about that at Thanksgiving
That's
dinner.
Great.
I'm glad that worked out for you.
You know, that, you know what that reminded me of is Zach, this guy that we know who works in a treatment facility. And when all of a sudden things escalate, he pulls out his teeth.
Yes.
He pulls out his teeth.
He's got dentures, of course.
And everybody just stops. And it totally shifts the energy.
Oh, my God. That's
He's
so
standing
funny.
There with his teeth in his hands.
Wow. Oh, I need to meet him. That is wonderful. And I need to get a set of, teeth to pull out. That is fantastic.
Well, another thing that Eddie and I have learned in our clinical supervision is to just get really low in your seat.
Oh, yeah,
the therapist
down.
Just kind of sinks down in the seat and says, I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. You guys figure it out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm going to go.
This might be more than I can handle.
Absolutely.
I don't know.
I'm going in my blanket fort over here. I'll see you guys later.
Yeah. Totally shifts things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Doesn't it? So I'm just curious to touch on trans, and in the time we have remaining, it may mm-hmm. be a big topic to take on, but what have you learned about transgenerational trauma and epigenetics?
Oof. Yeah, that is a big one. Yeah, so
just,
you know,
slice off a little piece.
Okay, all right. So I'll be a little science-y, and then I'll go a little bit into how that applies to kind of what I do clinically. How about that? So in the 90s, Time Magazine came out with this article that we pinpointed the gene for addiction, right? And everyone was like, oh, yay, now we can just take it away. So that is kind of correct. But the more recent research has indicated that we all are carriers of that gene, right? It's not selective. And it's not more like the important thing is not whether you're a carrier of the gene or not, but the important thing is there's a switch that mm-hmm. gets flipped.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So does the switch get flipped or not, right? So that explains why, you know, we can grow up in the same exact household, right? And like we can have the same genes, but you know, you may develop an issue and I don't, right? So that's what epigenetics is. Epigenetics is the study of how the switch gets flipped. And so if you've got transgenerational trauma, then you are inheriting lots of myelination, which is wiring in your brain that is mm-hmm. wired for experiencing things in a way that is very intense. And that may make you more susceptible to developing an addiction because your physiology feels bigger, right? It feels, those feelings feel bigger. So you're more likely to say, I don't want to feel that, right? Mm. Because it feels
for
so
self-protection.
Big.
Self-protection.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a coping skill that gets produced.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I believe that a lot of our behaviors we develop just because this is what we thought we had to do to survive.
Yes.
Whether we're
purposeful.
Children, adolescents, adults.
Yes. And it works for a while.
Yeah.
Sure does.
Yeah. It works for a while. And it does change our physiology and it does feel good, right? And then, you know, probably later on the consequences come and then
sure.
that's when it's time to make a different
but
choice.
But the good news is we can change our behavior and we can build new neural pathways in our brain.
Yes.
But it's only been, what, the last 30 years or so they've understood that we can do that?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah, the concept of neuroplasticity, right? That we, through continued growth and continued, you know, abstinence or whatever the behavior needs to change, that wiring can change and we can become, yeah, better.
As illustrated in your rat park example.
Yes, exactly.
Those little rats change their behaviors.
We don't need no stinking cocaine.
Yeah, they had hamster wheels on each other.
Foot
they were
massages.
So happy.
Yeah. We're good.
Yeah. Rat yoga.
So we take good care of ourselves mm-hmm. and recovery is possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So Monica LeBlanc, thank you so much for joining us. The hour has gone by so quickly. We could easily spend another hour. Appreciate the work that you're doing in the community. They can reach you at
CardinalRiverCounseling.com. All my contact information is there. And yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. This has just been such an honor.
And a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And thanks to our listeners for joining me once again. And join me next week when Jill Phoenix joins us talking about adverse childhood experiences and the healing potential of yoga and meditation.